Weather Service is calling for a big blizzard thing.
Yes, they are. But, you know, there's another reason why today is especially exciting.
Especially cold.
Especially cold, yeah. Okay. But the big question on everybody's lips.
Yeah, their chap lips.
On their chap lips,
chapped
right.
Lips.
Do you think Phil's gonna come out and see a shadow?
Punxsutawney Phil.
That's right, woodchuck chuckers. It's Groundhog Day! Get up and check that hog out there!
Yeah!
Come here, Groundhog!
Seems like we've tried to set up this recording like, I don't know, 10,000 times or something.
Mm-hmm. And each time something gets in the way until one day you learn to be selfless and then the recording went through.
Something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Exactly like that.
Who would have thought it would be harder to schedule a convenient time for the two of us when you're on vacation?
Yeah, well, I mostly blame the time difference and the fact that you can't be bothered to be up before 12. So,
that's not true at all.
Oh, yeah, I got the record to prove that one, mister.
I am up at 8 o'clock every day to take care of my dog, but that doesn't mean I remain conscious.
I'm sorry, could you say dog again?
Dog?
Yeah, no, more of a drawl, really.
Dog?
Yeah, that's how you did it.
Is it?
Yep.
Well, it turns out Andie MacDowell has a bit of an accent as well, which is her actual native accent in this movie.
It's not a good accent. I
but that's how she actually talks.
I know, and I kind of wish she didn't talk like that.
Well, Ramis let her do it, so, you know.
Yeah, what you gonna do?
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, do we have any business we want to get through?
Oh, I don't know. I'm just curious how you're surviving Florida.
Oh, yes, yes. So I am roving reporting from Tampa, Florida, and it is kind of cold, so that's okay. And sunny, not rainy. It's all right. Things are going okay. And I bought some chocolates, some chocolates from made in Florida, little truffles, as they were.
I thought it was all just seafood and margaritas down there.
No, that's it's a big option, though. I have had Pinot Grigio in a wine glass with ice cubes floating in it. So, in some townhouse crackers. So, just so you know, it's the pinnacle of classiness here.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Confirmed everything I've thought about Florida this whole time.
Well, of course, because it's almost everything exactly the same as Phoenix, Arizona.
The weather's actually really nice today. It's, you know, like mid to high 70s.
Oh, so it's not...
It's still being January.
It's not a barren hellscape over there, so that's great.
Oh, it's incredibly dry, so it is essentially a barren hellscape, but it's nice. It's nice. It's pleasant.
Hmm. It's dry hell. there was something I was going to talk to you about, and it's slipped my mind. Oh, I remember. So you were on a podcast recently.
You mean aside from this one?
Yeah, yes, of course I mean aside from this one. No, I'm not referring to our previous 32 episodes of the show. I am, of course, referring to your appearance on Stormy Mortal, Mr. Tomich's podcast.
Yes, indeed. I don't know why, but he decided I would be interesting to talk to for an hour, and I rather enjoyed speaking with him.
You were interesting to talk to. Now... Care to explain why I wasn't really defended when it came to the misrepresentation that I poo-poo everything?
Well, as you know, if I were to begin to pull at that thread, it would lead us down a rat hole that inevitably led to Firefly and Serenity, and I didn't want to open that door for the sake of not getting yelled at for 20 minutes.
Oh, yeah, because you just wanted to safely skate on by And just pretend like you're totally cool with Serenity and you don't have any negative opinions about it at all.
I don't have any opinions of it at all, to be honest, because I haven't seen any of it. And it doesn't really interest me.
No, you haven't seen Firefly, but you did see Serenity.
No, I haven't seen either of them.
I thought you saw Serenity because you watched the stupid camera shot at the beginning.
Oh, yeah, I have seen the opening shot. I don't know how I saw that out of context. Maybe it was just put in like a YouTube clip or something of like best oneer shots ever or something. But yeah, I've seen that shot, but I haven't seen anything else.
Oh.
To be perfectly honest, this whole elephant in the room of who likes and dislikes Firefly has actually interested me to the point that I almost want to watch an episode and just get a feel for it, just to see what it's actually like. But I didn't want to tell anybody, but you know, here I am telling, you know, the literally dozens of people who listen to this show. So if I had to ask you, who is on the record as being a cynic about such things, which one episode should I watch? Should it just be the first one?
No, I did not like that one. And it's especially confusing because there are actually multiple first ones because Fox made them reshoot the pilot. So I really don't think you would enjoy that at all. I'm trying to find the name of the good one that I liked. Because there was one.
I remember in your epic blog posts rating every single episode, you didn't love a lot of them and they were kind of scattered.
Yeah, well, there's some that are mostly just mediocre. Which is fine, but the one that I liked was Out of Gas.
I'm writing that on a card right now. Out of Gas. Now, am I going to miss any context from not having watched the rest of the series?
Yes, you won't understand a thing that's going on. So you have to watch all the terrible things too.
Oh, well, I just want to watch one to see what it's all about. So if I start at the beginning, am I going to hate it or hate myself?
You will not like the first episode. It is...
They're all of very different lengths, aren't they?
No.
I thought I looked it up and like the first one was like an hour and the next one was like 44 minutes and then the next one was like 30-something minutes. I don't remember.
Oh, well, I think the first one was just like an extra long one. I think it's actually two parts if you split it. Anyway, it doesn't matter because the first one wasn't actually the first one. The first one, the episode's called Serenity, and that wasn't broadcast first. The first one that was broadcast was called The Train Job, which I think is god awful, and I wouldn't recommend watching that. It's sort of like the cheeseballiest, lamest part of it. But that's kind of why I like the episode Out of Gas because it's not cheesy. It still has fun, though. You know, it's not like the Fantastic Four trailer where it's devoid of any entertainment or fun or anything.
Well, it looks like we're going to at least get a drum solo from Mr. Fantastic. I didn't realize he was the guy.
I don't know what to say about that trailer. It's just a dreadful trailer. Just dreadful.
There's an awful lot of voiceover that I can't imagine is actually in the movie, or at least I hope isn't in the movie.
Oh, someone had tweeted, I didn't realize they were making a sequel to Interstellar, and I almost spit up my drink.
Kind of feels like that, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. The fields of corn or whatever. And
yeah, there is a shot of a truck speeding down a dirt road, isn't there?
Yeah, and some space stuff that's probably never going to be explained. Just like some other movie. It just looks so dumb.
I mean, taking it seriously has worked for other folks in the past, but I'm not sure the Fantastic Four really lends itself to being taken seriously because it's not really rooted in the real world in the way Batman or Iron Man kind of are, to an extent.
I mean, let's put aside that those aren't really rooted in the real world.
I mean, as close as a Marvel movie comes, right?
Let's just say these are especially ridiculous because there is one guy who can stretch in any direction who's the rubber man or whatever, and he is literally called Mr. Fantastic. There is a woman that can turn invisible and make force fields, and there is a guy who can catch fire and fly for some reason because fire is lighter than air or something. Yeah. And then there's... a guy who's not really made out of rock, but kind of made out of rock. except for his eyes, which were mercifully spared by whatever tissue conversion process happened. And so, and then they fight villains like the Mole Man. Like, what are they going to do in the sequel when they have to fight the Mole Man? It's going to be like, oh, the dark and gritty Mole Man who rules the sewers with his... It's going to be stupid. I mean, it's literally like the end of the...
Sounds an awful lot like The Amazing Spider-Man.
I was going to say, it's literally like the end of The Incredibles when the Underminer comes up in his drill. And in, that is literally the Mole Man. Like, it just is ridiculous. Only imagine it in this context. So it's silly. And... I do understand the fear of just going straight to silliness because, let's just say there were two other prior Fantastic Four movies and I might've caught some of one of those things that was on TV, this week. It was a good way to spend your vacation, by the way. I was doing that thing you do where it's on TV. No, my mom was like, we should just have something on TV. And I was just like, there's nothing on TV. And she's like, what about the Fantastic Four? And it was just like, and then we watched it and it was just the dialogue so bad and the acting so bad. Fortunately, Chris Evans was salvaged from this to go on to be a different Marvel superhero. But Jessica Alba, God. Ugh.
Yeah, it's been a very long time since I've seen them, but I don't remember them being especially interesting. But is it safe to say that you're not really a fan of the Fantastic Four in any form?
No, that's not true. I like it in sort of like a campy, tongue-in-cheek kind of way. There was a series of comics for a while that I think it was Matt Fraction doing them, and the art style was kind of like sort of a chunky retro thing going on, and it sort of embraced the more ridiculous aspects of the Fantastic Four mythology, which is totally fine. Like, it's one of those things where if you're gonna have ridiculous superheroes, just acknowledge that they're ridiculous superheroes, and then you can spend the rest of your time telling human stories with them. Like, they don't have to just be like flat out goofy and do nonsensical things like they do in the previous Fantastic Four movie. And they don't have to be super serious all the time to the point where they can't have any joy. And then we're just laughing at them anyways because they're utterly ridiculous concepts. It's like with Batman, you can kind of pull it off a little bit. It's like, okay, so we are acknowledging the seriousness here. We're not going to make fun of the guy who dresses like a bat. We're going to pretend like this makes sense. Okay, I can go along on this journey.
If nothing else, we understand why he takes himself super seriously because, you know, he's just a rich guy with a weird hobby.
Mm-hmm.
But these guys are actual superheroes. But what I did want to ask you is, now again, I'm trying not to be overly cynical here. When I watch this trailer, especially compared to the old Fantastic Four, they look like children. They're all very, very young, especially comparatively. I don't know what the actual age is compared, but it looks like they went with deliberately younger people. Do you think that, since I know nothing about the comic, do you think that is more true to the comics, or do you think they're doing that with their fingers crossed that this is going to be a very long franchise and they want to make sure they get kids the right age so that they will last longer?
I'm assuming it's the latter, but it could be to cash in on some of that valuable youth money. I have no idea.
valuable youth money.
It's
strange. You think Whiplash has a large youth audience?
No, but Divergent did, I guess.
we can't get into Divergent. That's going to divert us down a very, very dark rat hole.
Yeah. Yeah, although it seems that Matt Alexander stole the costume designs for his new Foremost brand. Oh yeah, I went there, Matt. I went there. Well, of course you know I went there because I tweeted about it to you.
So
you're
rude.
Not going to listen to this.
He is never going to provide the wardrobe for our podcast now.
Mm. Yes, wouldn't that be interesting? Oh, wait, no. How do you know I'm not wearing it right now? I have the fur coat. Yeah, you couldn't hear that? That's the fur?
You mean the vest?
Yeah, the fur vest, and then this is the dress. Yeah, see, it's great stuff. It's good material. I'm so glad we had that promotional agreement.
Oh dear, you are making a powerful enemy right now.
Am I?
I would imagine.
Who am I making an enemy of? Exactly.
Mr. Volcano Owner? I don't know.
Oh, he doesn't listen. And he listens on planes. What's he going to do on a plane? It's 6 months, so he'll just get off of a plane in Heathrow and just be like, I listened to that thing, and you said that thing that I disagree with, and I'll be like, I don't even remember what this episode is about.
You're going to get an all-caps tweet just with J-O-E.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Hey, what's he going to do, send me more Volcano stickers? love you, Matt.
Oh, you know, I was looking through my calendar the other day, and I just scrolled through a little bit, and it... Let me see when I put it down on the calendar. Pardon my clicking. I'm clicking. Where did it go? Please, you can cut all this out. Okay, here it is. Wednesday, February 18th, I actually put in my calendar Volcano stickers 1 year old, and he actually beat my calendar item.
That's I'm very proud of him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it almost made it to a year, but no, he won.
Good work, Flo.
Yeah. Fantastical. I think it's on sale today.
Fantastical.
But by the time this
four.
Goes up. I don't know. No, not. Oh, God.
you didn't know I was joking at first. See, that's the kind of joy they should have in Fantastic Four.
The calendar stretches to fit your monitor as needed, and it will hide the things that you don't want to see, and then when you hit the delete button, it will set them on fire. And then a rock will hit them.
It sounds like some very complicated animated Rochambeau action going on your calendar items.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's whimsical. It's, you know, it's not quite skeuomorphic. It's just it adds a little bit of whimsy to the animations.
Oh, wouldn't that be a fun app for the millennials to have on their phones? Is you can basically do rock, paper, scissors, and if you successfully pull it off, then you add something to somebody else's calendar, and if you don't do it, then you don't add it to their calendar.
Winner gets write access to the other person's calendar.
Just for one item. That would be hilarious and stupid, but you know, Some VC would probably pour a ton of money into it.
I mean, it's no sillier than, yeah, yo.
Or that pizza thing. Remember that pizza thing?
Yeah, I still have it on my phone. It still doesn't work in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's no really... Well, yeah, there's a couple indie pizza places around here.
It's never going to take off.
That's not true.
And I believe I said something like that when it happened.
Well, it's working in major cities. It works in your city. Not
is
Florida.
It working if nobody uses it? If a pizza falls in a forest and no one's around to... I don't know.
Because you're not the demographic doesn't mean it's not working. Same thing with the Snapchats. These kids in their chats that are snapping.
Oh, God. What happened yesterday where everyone was talking about Snapchat all of a sudden? Did they announce something?
There was an update to the app that added a tab called Discover, which is an incredibly unique way to describe what it is. Basically there are channels now sponsored by, I don't know, like Discovery Channel or like Time Magazine or something, where you can watch like videos, curated videos or something in Snapchat form, which is not a thing I would want to do. But you know, in the vein of growing a platform in massive air quotes, I guess that's kind of a thing that, seems logical. I still don't understand the app at all.
Burn it to the ground and start over. Yeah, well, you're not supposed to, because it's apparently something for kids to do, and it's like, oh, we're going to get so much trouble if this, like, was actually on somebody's phone, but it's not, so we're totally not going to get in trouble. And it's like, I don't understand why anyone participates in this thing, because it's like, you just take a screenshot, and everyone does just take a screenshot. So then it's like, well, then the extra, what is the extra point to this? Like, literally everyone knows you can just take a screenshot.
Well, doesn't the app report when somebody takes a screenshot, or at least it's supposed to?
Oh, I have no idea.
Yeah, I think it's supposed to do that.
Well, too late for that. I mean, what are you going to do? Just be like, oh, you jerk, you did the thing. And then it'll be like, well, it's too late. They got your parts. So what are you going to do about it now?
I know plenty of people who use it for reasons other than that. But I've been trying out as many social networks as I possibly can just to see if they do, in fact, hold value in my mind as well as others, just to give them a shot, see what they're like. And I understand the Yik Yak one, especially because it has a nice little goofy drawing of a yak, which is kind of funny. But I do not understand the Snapchat. It just does not comport with my mind.
The Snapchat.
That's how I'm going to denigrate it and make it sound like I'm old and not with it and get off my lawn. Mm-hmm. Even though I don't have a lawn. My front yard is rocks.
Mm. Get off my rocks.
Although if I wait long enough. No, I would not say that.
Especially not on Snapchat.
Can Get Off My Rocks be the title of this episode?
No, I don't think so. Because we're talking about a nice romantic comedy, a nice wholesome romantic comedy where nobody takes advantage of anybody. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about that very shortly.
Can you imagine if he had Snapchat and Groundhog Day? Wait, Snapchat is Groundhog Day. Like you can, it's just gone. Like every single day, you could do the same thing over and over and over again, and no one would know.
That's not what makes Groundhog Day Groundhog Day, and they would know because they would have had the thing.
But there's no record.
But okay.
Moving on, I guess we're kind of in the movie part now.
Yeah. Well, thanks.
You want to continue on your streak of 2 weeks in a row of announcing the movie?
Groundhog Day was a movie. And it came out in 1993. And we're going to talk about maybe we'll talk about it now. Do you want to talk about this movie from 1993 called Groundhog Day?
Are we on NPR now? What has happened to you?
I don't know. I was trying to do a joke and then kaboom. So yes, the dogs that are grounded on the day. This is a classic, and I saw it in theaters way back in the day of 1993. And I quite like it. I don't watch it very often, but it is enjoyable, and it is eminently quotable. And it reigns supreme in pop culture. In terms of being a reference that literally politicians and the military will use to describe situations that are unending and appear to repeat over and over. It is quite fascinating in that way, even to the point where, let's say if you were fighting aliens and you had to keep fighting the aliens over and over again, someone might compare that to Groundhog Day. That is the pull that this movie has on people's lives.
Yeah, it's on TV all the time, but I swear I rented this on iTunes to watch it because I didn't even bother looking to see if I had it on DVD because I didn't want to get out of my chair. But it's one of those movies that I've seen the last 20 to 30 minutes of probably 300 times, but I think I maybe have seen the opening two or three scenes like twice ever. Which
I love the opening.
I do too. I didn't remember any of it because whenever I catch it on TV or wherever I watch it, I always see the end part, which it's a lot more compact than I thought it was. Like the things that, you know, you talk about the quotable bits are the ones that you always remember. Those are all like in the last like 30 minutes. There's a very definitive act structure, but apparently I only remember like the last act of the whole thing.
There are tons of quotes from the beginning that I talk about all the time. I mean, Ned Ryerson, the first time you meet Ned Ryerson is amazing.
Right, but he's in it all the way through to the end, so it's, again, maybe hard to tell when I'm quoting it from, but, you know, there's so much repetition that it almost feels like you've seen the whole thing.
Bing.
Yeah,
Bing, bing, bing.
I saw the tweet.
Bing.
You think that's where they got the name?
God, I hope not. That would be terrible. Could you imagine if they had Ned Ryerson pitch Bing to you? Like, if Microsoft was just like, oh, we have the perfect spokesperson for this. Ned Ryerson? Ned? Phil? Phil Connors, is that you? Am I right or am I right?
That would explain why the results are not necessarily what you want them to be, but more like what they want them
right
to be.
Am I right or am I right? Am I right or am I right? Am I right? Right? Am I right?
My favorite Ned Ryerson quote is at the end there, the where are we going? Oh, let's not spoil it. He goes, oh, I just got that. And he does that weird sort of like growl laugh. Yeah. And then just wanders away.
He slinks off. it is a very strange and unique movie. Shall we talk about the sort of technical components of the setup here? not necessarily going through every scene, but I just mean, like, I think it sets it up really well. We have this, you know, the credits, but over clouds, and then we dissolve from the clouds to the blue screen, so we set up that he's a weatherman.
And he's Bill Murray as a weatherman, which is quite hilarious.
Yes, and he is so contemptuous of literally everything. This also sets up his relationship with the camera guy, who he doesn't get along with, and the other people at the station, who he doesn't get along with, because he's just a jerk. But he's Bill, you know, he's Bill Murray, so he is a likable enough jerk in movie form. In real life, I'm not sure I would enjoy spending much time with Bill Murray. This also sets up his eventual love interest of Rita, who is wearing blue on the blue screen and having a blast.
In her opening scene, she's like, she's got like this childlike excitement where she's just like wandering around on the weatherman blue screen and like just waving and staring at the camera and laughing. It was the weirdest thing, because it's pretty different from the rest of her character. I mean, she always has this sort of like innocent likability through the rest of the movie, but she doesn't have this sort of like childlike attitude, because I guess she's dealing with Bill Murray instead of just on her own. But that's one part where I did not remember that from the beginning of the movie, where she's just kind of in her own little world there.
But see, the thing is, I know a lot of people don't like Andie MacDowell. I don't have any strong feelings about Andie MacDowell one way or the other. But for her character, I have to agree that she's a little bland, but they try to like goofball her up a little bit, like to give her a little quirky nerdiness, but it doesn't really ever seem to work out. And it's one of those things, if you're paying close attention, you'll find all of the oddball things, like the sweet vermouth on the rocks with a twist. God, who would drink that?
Evidently, according to the internet, that is Harold Ramis's wife's favorite drink.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mrs. Ramis. I didn't mean to make fun of your favorite drink, but ugh, revolting. I mean, I like sweet vermouth in a Manhattan, but very little of it.
Itself, it is an odd drink, isn't it?
No, the idea of just drinking a whole glass of sweet vermouth with slowly melting ice inside of it is just ugh. But anyway, moving on. If this were to be redone in a modern day, I can easily see her part being played by Zooey Deschanel instead of by Andie MacDowell. And it might actually be a better performance by Zooey Deschanel, who does the ditzy, weird, quirky, but competent and has agency role better than I think Andie MacDowell manages to pull off here. I don't despise Andie MacDowell in the film. I don't think she's 100% effective. She doesn't bring it all to bear.
Yeah, I don't know. On the Elf episode, I think I discussed a little bit Zooey Deschanel's sort of somewhat serious work, and especially when there's like love interest stuff that end up getting partially serious. I don't super love her in those kinds of roles, but Andie MacDowell does what she needs to do, and I think she's the realistic counterpart that sort of makes it work, especially in the. I don't know. There's enough of her backstory with the whole studying French poetry or whatever it was, and the fact that she understands herself, and Bill Murray's kind of living in this delusional world where he thinks he's bigger than he is, and it all leads up to, you know, their spoiler jumping ahead, where he's trying to hook up with her, and she just ends up slapping him no matter which direction. He takes his flirting, but it seems like that speaks to her character, whether or not there's a lot there to it. It's kind of hidden from the audience, but it feels like there's something there. But yeah, I mean, she's a bit mellow at times, but that's okay, because Murray is the center of our attention the whole time.
No, well, see, this is what I'm getting at, is like the character, I get her performance in that role, I think, is just not 100%. The slapping, all that. Yeah, it's all good.
It was the 80s. Oh, wait, no, it was 1993, but it felt like the 80s to me.
Well, it they have montages.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of montages.
Yeah, tons of montages. And very competently executed filmmaking here in this film. Because we very quickly set up what the entire day is like for him. And this is the sort of typical day. And once he wakes up that second time, then things start to change, and we start to see the day repeat over and over and over again. But it's so very cleverly, lays out the blueprint so that we can fill in the blanks every time they rotate through one of these revolutions of the cycle, that we don't need to like literally see everything that happens every time after that. We can fill in all the blanks, and I really like it.
Yeah, which is a weird thing to say, because it does feel like a really tightly written and assembled movie, especially when we use the montages to give us all the information that we need without necessarily having to sit through all of it. But it's still an hour and 40 minutes long, and it really doesn't feel like that to me. It feels, I mean, especially because in the beginning there, we get right into the meat of the whole thing. It feels like a really, like, again, nothing is wasted in this movie, and every bit of it adds to the story, and I really enjoyed that. But there were a couple things I found online, which, you know, again, various interviews here and there can be debated, I'm sure. But it turns out, like, the original script for this movie apparently came in when it started with Bill Murray already in his time loop, just kind of like mid-cycle, and he was just miserable because he was explaining to us how he was stuck, and there was nothing to be done about it. Like, it didn't actually show the pre-time loop world for him.
Yeah, and I agree with Ramis that it is important to show the pre-time loop world of him, not just showing the pre-time loop world, but of his realization that he is in the loop, because I think that is part of the sort of the magic of this, whether you want to call it like entertainment that he's being tortured like this or whatever, but the enjoyment, really, the good stuff happens when we're along on this ride with him. If we were starting, you know, 30 minutes into this film, 40 minutes into this film, then I wouldn't feel the same way about this, because by that point he's already just manipulating people to get what he wants out of situations. And that you wouldn't really be on his side, and he wouldn't really have that arc where we also see what he was like before the day had started. So I'm very happy they did this way, and structurally.
In the time loop, he does fluctuate, though, from being a jerk to being kind of helpless to being a good person, and it could kind of be said that he's the same sort of jerk in the beginning of the time loop that he is before the time loop. But yeah, I agree that the seeing him beforehand is helpful. That idea feels more like something that would work in a book, where you have more sort of voiceover and commentary that the audience gets. But the other thing, did you read what the original alternate ending was that they rewrote?
Yeah, that it was going to be her waking up and then she's in the loop.
What the hell would be the point of that?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm very glad they didn't do either of those things. I think that wouldn't have been good structurally. I think it would have had a very strange ending. The way that it ends right now is much more, you know, Dickensian Christmas story-esque, Christmas Carol-esque or whatever, like where, you know, they wake up and now's the chance to go on with your life after being tortured for like 10,000 years.
Ramis said he thought it was something like 30 to 40 years. I know that the writer said something like 10,000, but it's interesting just to have the context in the back of your mind watching this movie to think like, all right, this arc in his character where he goes from a jerk to like doing whatever he wants because there are no rules, to like kind of hopeless and killing himself, to like trying to be a good person. Just imagine 40 years of the exact same thing over and over again, which, I mean, living in the suburbs, I can imagine that pretty well. But like, yeah, that's an interesting context to have in the background of your mind when watching this movie.
Yeah. Well, that is also one of the things that the movie does effectively, is that we don't need to see every single time. And sometimes he makes reference to things that have happened in previous loops, or he just does things and we get the understanding that he learned to do them. Like, for instance, we see him start with the piano lessons, but we don't see him start with ice sculpture lessons. He just starts doing the ice sculpture. But because we had seen piano lessons before and we had seen him learning French poetry before, we're just able to shorthand that. We just know that he can do the ice sculpture stuff now. We don't need to like have him also go to the ice. Like, if we had to literally go with him every time he learned something, it would be tedious. And
it would take us 30 years.
Yeah. And we, like with the bank robbery, which happens very early on, I was surprised how early it was. I had forgotten. where he takes the bag from the guys delivering money to the bank, the old men that are clueless. He has worked out exactly what they're saying to one another, and he has worked out the timing of what they're doing, and he has worked out who all of the people are enough to come up with this plan to do this thing and steal the money. And we don't need to see the loop of him figuring all this stuff out. We just know that he knows this because he's been through other loops. And that is actually pretty early on in the film. It's like one of the first things after he realizes he can just do whatever he wants and gets away with it. So I quite like that.
A lot of good writing, a lot of good editing.
Now, the downside to that is he basically took advantage of, I want to say, almost everyone in the town. Like,
at least once, yes.
Yeah, yeah. It's super weird and creepy and strange, especially the first setup with Nancy, which...
Yeah, because that comes right out of, like, he knows exactly what he's doing right from the get-go, and he sits down and he has that list of questions. What's your name? Where'd you go to high school? What was your English teacher's name? All right, see you later. And then just walks off. It's like, oh, boy.
Yeah, and then the next scene... God, it was so skeezy and gross. It's just like, ugh, this guy, it was nasty. It was like pickup artist stuff. And he goes on to do that not just with Nancy, but with all of these other women, with the one who was dressed like a French maid, with Andy McDowell's character. He tries to like come up with the perfect date, which is quite possibly the part of the movie I find the most uncomfortable to sit through. It's not until after that that he realizes that he shouldn't, that doing that isn't really getting him anything. It's not going to fulfill anything for him. Once he's defeated by Andy McDowell, like, I don't know, 30, 40 times, that it really sets in motion things later on where he's no longer taking advantage of people, but he does still know all of those things because he makes reference to it later when he talks about how Nancy is like a chipmunk when she gets excited, or whatever it was he said. It was just like,
she makes noises like a chipmunk when she gets really excited.
Oh, so creepy.
Yeah, I did not remember the part where, and it comes right after he steals the money, so I guess the implication is that he used that money to buy that very nice old Mercedes, which I guess there's a Mercedes dealership in Punxsutawney, who knew, but why, he's just like off the deep end where he's going to see a movie dressed up like Clint Eastwood, and he has convinced his date, whoever that lady was, to dress up like a French maid because they're going to a costume party or something. Some of the things that he does... that seem despicable, I wonder how much of them could just be attributed to just genuinely snapping mentally, because you have no idea, like everything is exactly the same every single day. Like you would literally lose your mind after a while. I mean, even the first day he ends up going to the psychiatrist because he's concerned, but it's one of those things that you miss in the montage, is because it's obviously glossed over for time, but like what was his mental state throughout all of this, aside from just like being manipulative and then being depressed and then trying to get on his own two feet again? But like, how much would that screw with you if you were just a regular guy? And then it's almost like walking around in a world where everyone is frozen and you're just like, well, here I am for the rest of my life.
Yeah, well,
it's like a Twilight Zone thing.
Well, it is kind of like a Twilight Zone thing, only with a happier ending. But he does kind of, we can see his emotional state pretty clearly, I think, because at the start of the time, before the start of the time loop, he's pretty miserable. At the start of the time loop, he is miserable and he has anxiety and he's freaking out and doesn't know if he's the only one. And then when he comes to accept this at the bowling alley later, and he goes along with the ride, that's when he goes on this really crazy manic spike. And that lasts for several scenes in the film until he finally feels shut down by Andy McDowell and he gets super depressed and kidnaps Punxsutawney Phil. he goes to the quarry.
Don't drive angry. Don't drive angry.
Maybe he's okay. Kaboom.
Probably not. That's the scene I imagine when, like, in one of the trivia things that I read, it said he got bit by the groundhog, like, twice and had to get rabies shots or something. That's the scene I imagine the groundhog biting him, because he was kind of wrestling him with him when he was doing the Don't Drive Angry. They were just rolling on that, and it looked like the groundhog was getting really upset.
Yeah. And he proceeds to go through and kill himself many times, and there's the death montage of him killing himself. And it's so strange that we still see the events unfold after he dies. So it's clearly not just constrained to his consciousness, whatever is happening.
Yeah, that is a little weird, though, doesn't it? It kind of feels like it breaks the time loop a little bit.
Yeah. And it's nice to have the reaction shot in a way, but at the same time, it makes you focus on the fact that they are reacting instead of time just resetting, which is a little peculiar, but it's fine. So basically, it has maybe more to do with the town than with him, but who has any idea, really? It doesn't really need explanation, which I'm fine with.
Do you think that means that this 24 hours plays out all the way through every single time and then resets at 6 a.m., and whether or not he dies in the middle of the day or not, the rest of the day plays out and then resets itself? Or does it reset itself when he dies?
I'm assuming it doesn't reset until that time is hit. And that whole entire time, he's been dead for hours, which is weird to think about, because then it's like, well, he wouldn't have any awareness of being dead, I guess, and he doesn't... There are no moments where he talks about going to, like, heaven or something like that. Like, he has no other recollection after these events have happened. But
yeah, I guess when he dies, he'll just wake up at 6 a.m. because he's missing that chunk of the day, but the rest of the day theoretically happens.
Yeah, I mean...
I'm looking for logic in a time loop here. I should probably stop.
Yeah, you know... Well, there are worse things. It's not Bill and Ted. But he
substantially less 80s hair metal in this movie.
Yes, yes. Two heads are better than one.
No. Let's not bring that up again.
Let's never bring that up again. Two heads are better than one. One of the death scenes that I did not care for at all was the jumping off the clock tower one, because it's in slow motion. And you can see it's a stunt double the whole entire time. You're looking at his face. It's like, that's not Bill Murray. He's very distinctive facial features. I don't know why you did that in slow motion, because it kind of takes me out of the moment. All the other scenes are creative, I think. The toaster. You want some toast? He doesn't say anything to Mrs. Lancaster and just walks up the stairs. There's a certain morbid quality to all of this, because suicide is, of course, not a good thing, especially not killing yourself repeatedly. But there is something to this in that it's sort of a teachable moment, because he can't actually kill himself. So then he eventually is able to come out of this slump and get back on the horse, and apparently it turns into an issue of self-improvement at that point. And where in the past he had been learning things in order to manipulate others, now he's learning things in order to better himself, because he's got nothing else to do at this point. He's living for himself at this point. He's still going through the loop, but this is what eventually gets him to a point where he is able to throw a party and know everyone in town, and they all love him, in the matter of less than a full day, and he is finally able to have a friendship and a love that is not just a lust, and that is what gets him out of the time loop. It has that really weird emotional thing where we start off with the panic and then the manic intensity of being able to manipulate, and then the depression, and then back up through the self-improvement and picking himself back up by the bootstraps. And then finally getting out of it, because he's no longer concerned with everything. So it's sort of an interesting psychological arc.
Yeah. Yeah. I like the direction the arc takes too, because it starts off with sort of that childish fantasy that could be pervasive in any number of movies that had some sort of a time loop, where it's like, well, time doesn't matter. Like, let's go act up. And then, you know, he's kind of in his adolescence there, but then he eventually comes to realize that that's not a fulfilling life, and he gets bummed out about it. But then eventually, as grown-ups do, once they reach a certain age, they realize that they have control over their own life and they can do whatever they want that makes them happy. And rather than just being selfish or childish or lazy or whatever it is, he actually decides to go after the things that he thinks would be interesting. Like, there's no indication that we think that learning piano is something he's doing to make other people like him. It seemed like, you know, I've got some free time. You know, this seems like something interesting. Like, I've read all these books. I've done all these different things. I've helped people, which is like the easy stuff that he seems to do just along the way because he knows what's going on in the town. But like, he's really just, he's exploring his own interests, which is kind of like, again, the adulthood of his time loop, which eventually leads him to being a whole person that is actually worthy of being cared about instead of just this illusion of somebody who has something in common with somebody else so he can try and trick them to getting into bed with him.
Yeah, and, you know, I think you said something really good here when you brought up the sort of adolescence to it, because there is this petty selfishness that he had before the movie starts, and he maintains through this part of the film. The petty selfishness over all of the idiotic crap that's going on, the snowballs and stuff when he's trying to like set up his perfect date with Rita and he's finally sick of these kids, and he's
the second time they play that scene, it is so uncomfortable, and you can see it on Rita's face. She's like, what is with this guy? Because he goes through the motions again where he's like, oh god, kids are throwing snowballs at us, and then like they flop down on the ground and he's like trying to get into that comfortable like, oh, we just happened to fall into the snow next to each other position. But you can tell he's done it like 20 times and he's got that really creepy fake smile on his face, and it's just like, oh my god, you can tell that she feels it. It's just like, this, there's something not right about this.
Yeah, and one thing I had criticized Andie MacDowell's effort that she had put into being super likable. I will not criticize her ability to control and dictate the terms on which Murray is able to advance his agenda. let's say she's very confident and assured in that she knows what she does and doesn't want, and she doesn't allow him to manipulate her to that extent. And it does indeed preserve her honor, and that is the thing that he gets so frustrated with, which makes him into like a total freaking weird creepy jerk. While she comes off, you know, looking like a human being with agency, and like she did not fall for him and, you know, love him unconditionally and all of this stuff just because he had decided to learn some French poetry or decided to learn about her history or decided to learn about what she hopes to do in the future, you know?
Yeah, and it's kind of indicative of, you know, the look on his face when he first sees her. He's got a little bit of that intrigue that she's, you know, dancing in front of the blue screen, but you can clearly tell that he's interested. And it's the same sort of thing that he does with Nancy, but clearly Nancy and Rita are very different characters. But yeah, the other thing I wanted to bring up about this, which I don't know if this is me being just overly critical, but Bill Murray in this role of like the male love interest always kind of weirds me out a little bit, because he's super charismatic and he's the kind of person you always want to be around, but like, I don't really ever see him as a reasonable love interest. And, you know, he's kind of the same in Ghostbusters, but not like, it's clearly not reciprocated all that much from Dana. And in this one, I don't know, it seems to be that there's at least a base level of attraction from Rita to, you know, allow the rest of the plot to pursue. But she's really looking for some sort of personality in him before she'll even like let her guard down and say like, okay, this is a person I actually want to be close to and talk to. Like, she's intrigued in multiple instances where she's just weirded out or concerned, or like this whole the whole, I want to follow you around for the rest of the day because I believe that, you know, because he was given a spiel about I'm a god and he knows all of the stuff in the diner. She's intrigued by that, but she's not anywhere. She's not considering this whole like love interest angle until way, way, way later. And you barely even get a glimpse of it when he's doing his whole trickery. But way down the line, when he's actually becoming an interesting person, it's his personality that is the draw for her, which is, I think, a benefit to her character.
Yeah. Well, it is also the really creepy thing, too, about him is that he also, like you're saying, I don't really buy him very much in the romantic lead role. I very much buy him as a jerk. I understand the charisma that he can put off when he's putting his effort into it, when he's on, as they say. But with all of the women in the town that seem to like him... And I'm counting the engaged couple that are going to get married, but she is having second thoughts. I'm counting her in this, and I'm also counting Bill, the waiter who paints toy soldiers. I just don't see the appeal. So maybe it is because he is just manipulative of these people on such a crazy level because of this time loop. But if that time loop wasn't there, I would like to think that they're not all interested in him. If he was putting forth,
well, he is a local celebrity though, so there is something to be added there.
Yeah, I guess from Pittsburgh. But
is that a burn on Pittsburgh?
A little bit. I've been to Pittsburgh. It's nice. I went to Primanti's. I don't like Primanti's sandwiches. They put French fries on the sandwiches. I don't understand. That's not a cheesesteak. Philly cheesesteak trumps Pittsburgh cheesesteaks. Bring it on, Yinzers. And then
I think I have family in Pittsburgh, but I don't know.
Oh, well.
Never been personally.
It's close to the Ohio area, so maybe you
yeah.
do.
I'm pretty sure I do.
Yeah, well, it's your Midwest, Southwest heritage. It's all good stuff. Enjoy some fries on a cheesesteak. On white sandwich bread. What was I saying? My train of thought. He's a minor celebrity in the sense that he's the weather guy from Pittsburgh, but the it doesn't explain much about. I wouldn't buy it that all these other people would be interested in him because it's not like he has a girlfriend or a wife or an ex-wife or anything at the beginning of the film. So I at least none that we're aware of, and seemingly. Andy McDowell and Larry neither have anything going on in the real world outside of this town. It's very convenient. I just don't buy him in a romantic lead role when he's not armed with the ability to use a time loop to get on someone's good side and to see what does and doesn't. You know, upset them. And then at that point, he's just being a Svengali. It has nothing to do with his personal appeal as a human being.
Yeah, I think at the end of the movie, though, he does have enough personality and appeal to be a legitimate love interest in that he's a good, kind-hearted person for the right reasons, and he's interesting because he's lived this life of exploration, and he's got he's a musician, he's well read now, he realizes that, you know, he shouldn't be a jerk and he should help people because it's a good thing to do, and that's admirable. So by the end of the movie I get it, but yeah, there are times where I go like, you're Bill Murray, you're supposed to be funny, you're not supposed to be the love interest. But anyway,
but this is also this other thing at the end of the film. I have to imagine that if we kept going from here, eventually we'd get some really awkward stuff because he does know so much more about her than he ought to know. And it knows more about like everyone. He says he wants to move there. And it's like, well, how long can you go now without saying any of those things you technically should not know? Like if you open up your mouth and you say something, and they're like, how do you know that? I never told anybody that. And then you're like, I think you told me that one time. It's like, you know, sneaking around and reading someone's email or something like that. Like, it's going to catch up to you. this is probably why Snapchat is so great. But
well, I would like to imagine that in this 30 to 40 year time loop, he spends more than half of it on the good improvement parts. And, you know, the reason we see most of the naughty, selfish stuff is because that's the character building stuff that the movie is interested in. But I like to imagine that he put that stuff to the side pretty quickly comparatively in this 40 year long journey of his. And it's not to say he forgot all of these things, but it's to say that they were less important in his life than just what he was doing on a daily basis, because his life would, once he stopped like trying to manipulate people, he was less interested in the day-to-day goings on of the people around him. And he was just doing his thing. And, you know, they were there and maybe he learned stuff along the way, but, you know, for if he were to spend just 20 years doing his own thing, maybe that he wouldn't remember that stuff as much, or he would just let it go. And maybe once it's actually a new day, you know, that enough is different that when he's doing his manipulative stuff, maybe he is really more focused on the just give me the information about who, what, when, where I need to get what I want. But then once, you know, he's not really digging too deep under the surface, except maybe with Rita, that these other people, he doesn't really know them that well. He knows enough to manipulate them in the situation that keeps repeating itself, but maybe he doesn't know, you know, every intimate detail about Ned or about Buster, played by his brother, or all these other people. He just knows that, you know, okay, this guy's going to choke on a steak over here at this time, and I'm going to go save him and all that stuff. But it is something that would be interesting to see where they went if they were to continue the movie, just to see how much he knows. And do you think, I don't think in the end of the movie here, in his last day in the loop, I don't think he did reveal his time loop godlikeness to Andy McDowell, but I kind of imagine that he would at some point. I mean, it might freak her out. Or do you think once he's on to the next day, do you think he's just going to completely forget all of that and just say, nope, never happened, and just focus from, you know, going forward? Do you think he would tell Rita that he was stuck in a time loop for 40 years on February 2nd, even though it's now February 3rd and he doesn't care anymore?
I don't know. And see, this is the thing that is kind of ambiguous. On the one hand, he could tell her, and she, because he knows that she won't get rid of him over it, because she told him, he told her once before, and they went through a whole day together and, you know, stayed up till 6 a.m. or whatever. So he knows that she's not going to be so freaked out that she'll leave, which would be a concern now that he can't do it over again. But on the other hand, it's like, well, then what's the point of telling her? Because then we're just always going to talk about all of my weird years and this time loop thing that didn't really happen-ish, sort of. Who's to say? It's a shame that Kit could never make a sequel to it, where we go through her time loop. No, just kidding. Please don't do that. One other weird thing is by the end of the production of this, Bill Murray and Harold Ramis were not getting along anymore. They had a falling out. So maybe that's another reason not to make a sequel.
Yeah, I think I read something about that too. I think what they said, you know, Bill Murray was in the middle of a divorce while filming this, and that probably didn't put him in the best mental state for shooting a movie, especially when you're trying to be directed. And I guess he was very kind of short with Ramis, just saying like, am I supposed to be good or bad in this scene? Just tell me that and then just go away, or like, stop talking to me right now because I'm not in the mood. But I mean, you know, Bill Murray's weird enough as is. If you imagine he's going through, you know, some actual personal problem, maybe he's not super friendly, because he's kind of elusive as a regular human being.
Well, and add on to that, there's this weird recounting of a story from, was it Stephen Tobolowsky or
Ned Ryerson?
Yeah. Where he had mentioned that on the last day of filming, that Murray, for the end scene on February 3rd, that he wasn't going to shoot it unless he knew what he was wearing before he shot it. It's here on Wikipedia. Final scene, Stephen Tobolowsky at Groundhog Day 2010 in Punxsutawney recalled the making of the final scene. There's this whole weird thing there. And
Ramus wasn't sure like what he should be wearing, if it's supposed to be the pajamas or if he's supposed to be wearing the clothes from the night before. And he put it to a vote with the crew, and the crew were split down the middle. And then one girl, it was her first film, and she was the assistant set director or something. She raised her hand and said that he should absolutely be wearing the clothes from the night before and not the pajamas, because otherwise it would ruin it. And then Ramus said, okay, fine, that's what they're going to do. And then that's why he's wearing this clothes at the end. But it's strange that they had such a contentious thing that Murray's like, I'm not going to shoot this until I know what the character's wearing. It's very strange.
Yeah, I thought that story was interesting and probably has a little bit more weight in it because that paragraph in Wikipedia comes after the one where they're talking about how they had the falling out. But that's totally a legitimate question I would expect from an actor, because it kind of it explains the way out of the time loop. Because, you know, if Murray's been doing this for 40 years, I can't imagine he's really going to put his pajamas on every night before bed. He's just going to do as much as he can do every single day, and he's going to pass out and he's going to wake up in his pajamas because that's just how the time loop goes. But I can't imagine he would care, especially if he was just trying to spend as much time as he could with Rita before he fell asleep or she fell asleep or whatever. But I don't know why Ramus had a problem with this or why he couldn't figure it out on his own. Maybe it was just he was too engrossed in the struggle with Murray. But yeah, I agree with apparently the only girl on the set who said this. He would absolutely be wearing the clothes from the night before, because why would he care to change his clothes? He's just doing his thing, and then he wakes up every day in his pajamas. I can't imagine why he would ever do something different.
Yeah, no, and I agree on that with you and with whoever this anonymous person was that Ned Ryerson is commenting on.
Yeah, and the reason I think that's a reasonable thing to be asked from an actor, and the reason Bill Murray wouldn't shoot it, is because, like, yeah, your job as the director is to have an answer for everyone. And if you're if somebody asks you something and you say, I don't know, or let's take a vote from the crew, that's how you lose faith from your actors and crew. You're supposed to have an answer for all of this stuff, especially if you're the writer and producer and director of this thing. Like, come on, Ramus, get it together. But yeah, it's an interesting story to add on top of all of this other lore about how this kind of ended their relationship for about 10 years or so.
Yeah. Well, such a shame. I hope they patch things up together before, unfortunately, Mr. Ramus was no longer with us. Well, that's a sad note. speaking of sad deaths, there is a moment in here where he gets really depressed in that he can't fix or change something. He realizes all he can do is provide comfort to the old homeless man begging that we see at the beginning of the time loop, all the way through every time he walks down that street, until finally that guy, you know, dies and he can't deal with the situation where he can't fix it. He's not a god and can't, you know, rush in and then change the way things are going by, you know, taking some lesson or learning the Heimlich maneuver or doing anything else. Like, he can't be a superhero that can resolve this. That the guy is just going to die, and that's life, and the nurse is trying to explain that to him. And he tries to just comfort the guy, and it's just like giving him soup and like just taking him out, calling him pops, you know, doing stuff together. It is an interesting way for him to realize sort of boundaries and limits that he had not considered before.
Yeah, I like that loop. That montage loop, or whatever you want to call it, in particular, because it kind of works along with the getting slapped repeatedly by Rita, where he's kind of, you know, he's bummed out and he's baffled that he can't find his way around it to manipulate the situation to get what he wants with Rita. But like, oh well, that happens. There are other women that he can go manipulate and be a weirdo. But, you know, for some reason he gets hooked on helping out this old guy, and he comes to like him, and he's helping him out, and he's doing something nice. But he eventually realizes the futility of it, and he starts doing nice things because it's the right thing to do, not because he's trying to like circumvent the laws of predestiny or whatever it is. But it's another like low point for him, but not a low point in like, I don't know what to do, I'm just going to kill myself, but a low point in realizing that, you know, he needs to be the best person he possibly can and do the things that he knows are the right things to do, even if he has no control over how the actual outcome or what it's actually going to do for or to other people. He just knows that this is the right thing to do and I'm going to do it. And it's almost like him moving on from the time loop, even though he's still stuck in the time loop. He's just going to do his best, end result be damned, and just try and be a good person. And it's a very serious portion of the movie, but it works really well, I think.
Yeah. It is a moment where he has some personal growth, and he does go on to like save other people and stuff, in sort of like a superhero montage.
You have never thanked me, you little jerk.
I love that. And the old ladies. Oh, I think he's from the auto club. It is a very peculiar thing. This movie and the lessons that he learns and the ways he learns them. And I don't even know if he learns them. Well, this is another thing to talk about with editing, is I don't know if he technically is learning all of these things in the sequence we see them in the film, or if some of these things he's been learning at different intervals. I assume it's in the sequence that it is in the film, and just compressed, and it's not that they're lumping things together in certain scenes. I don't know what your feelings on that are.
What in particular do you mean?
Oh, like, maybe some of the piano lesson stuff happened earlier, but they just put it all together towards the end. Like, do you think it all was just together towards the end? Because I do as well. But, you know, it could be interpreted in a variety of ways, because they don't really explicitly explain the linearity of each of the montages, like if there's overlap between them. Because, like, did he literally just go and do piano lessons every single day all the time and nothing else? Or were some of those other montages, including clips that happened on those piano days, et cetera?
Yeah, that would be my estimation. I think he would probably be trying to slowly craft the perfect day where he does all of this good stuff and he has time for all of his errands and his personal growth and all that stuff. Because I don't think in this quest to be a better person, he's just going to say, like, I'm just going to let that kid fall out of the tree and go into a coma because he cracked his head on the sidewalk for, you know, 12 years out of this loop because I want to get really good at the piano. I think it's kind of part of his character building that he tries to do all of these things every single day. But for the purposes of storytelling, we have to see the montage of helping people and the montage of pianos sort of gathered together, because otherwise we would potentially get confused in the retelling of the progression of these things, you know, how he got better at these things or did more of this or more of that. So I think the montages are bundled for the audience, but I think he probably is doing all of these things every day if he can.
And
maybe it's just that once he nails, like, once he has the catching the kid and fixing of the flat tire and all that stuff, like, in his schedule, and he knows that that's a thing he's going to do, that we don't have to see that again. So that's why the montage happens, and then we don't revisit it, because we don't need to see him doing those things again. But once he has that portion of his day, his quote-unquote errands done, where he's helping people, then we move on to the other parts where we're doing the montage. But he's still doing those other things in the background.
Yeah, this does bring up a very strange thing, too. At the very end of the film, one of the things that we see for the first time is the party that he organizes, or at least has his hand in. And so presumably he was doing, like you're saying, all of those other events because everyone in the town loves him enough to go to this party and say nice things about him. So they've all, in the span of, I don't know, by the time they have this party, maybe it's been 6 or 8 hours. In some cases, I'm sure he met some of these people 2 or 3 or 4 hours ago. But he met all of them in that day, perfectly timed it out to hit all of these things, to go see the piano teacher, to learn piano for the first time. Because none of these people remember anything from any of the prior loops. So he's literally met every single one of them this day and gotten to know them well enough that they are all excited to go there and hang out with him and say nice things about him. And he's gone and done the car stuff, and he's gone and saved the kid from the tree, and he's gone and taken the piano lessons, and he's et cetera. So I don't know how he did all of those things and organized this party for for the, it, and presumably we don't know, we don't even know if this is the first time he's had this party or if he's been having this party every day for like 10 years and he's finally worked it out to get everybody to the point where they're happy. And then once everyone's happy, if that's when we're coming in on this and seeing Andy McDowell's reaction to that, or if he's had prior versions of this party where not everyone was happy and things with Andy McDowell didn't work out to the point where they did this one time. Since there aren't any other editions of this in the loop, we don't know if it's just compressed and removed or if it's actually literally the first time he's done the party.
I never got the feeling that the party was organized by him, although he kind of worked his way into performing in it. I can't remember off the top of my head. Maybe I'll rewatch it after we do this. But there's the like the first day that they get stuck after the blizzard, and he goes and he says, "I'm just going to sit at this bar and drink and then go take a hot shower or whatever." I thought he was turning down an invitation to go with Rita and Larry to the party. Maybe I'm just adding that in myself. Maybe they were going to go to dinner or something else. But I thought the party was just a Groundhog Day celebration thing put on by the town. And he just became a part of the town and said, like, "Oh, let me go play up there with the band. I know how to do some stuff too." But the larger point, even if it is not his party, you are right that I didn't consider that he had to have done all of these things that day before the party, or he would not have had that montage of everyone coming up saying thank you, up to and including, you know, he saved the marriage where it was going to, where they were having the second thoughts, and then got them WrestleMania tickets. So he apparently spent some time with them. Along with everyone else.
Yeah.
But, you know, they kind of gloss over some of it. Like the old ladies refer to him as just the gentleman from the motor club or whatever. So he didn't spend too much time with them. He just spent enough time to give them a new tire and send them on their way and, you know, just say, like, you know, happy to help and all that stuff. But, yeah, he's got a busy day ahead of him.
Yes. Every day is a busy day. I think it was actually a dinner that they were inviting him to, if I remember correctly, but I might be wrong.
Well, that was
it could have been
that was definitely
party.
The first day. Yeah, the night before they definitely invite him to dinner, and he says, "I've seen Larry eat," and he does that weird awkward thing where he shoves his fist in his mouth. But the second day after they get turned back by the blizzard, I'm not sure. By the way, do you have any comments on the CGI snow when they're driving down the freeway?
Not so bad. I mean, considering it was 1993, whatever. I'm more bothered by the stunt guy than I am by that.
Well, I have to use Jurassic Park as our metric, but like I rented this in HD. I'm not sure how many times I've ever seen this in HD, but when they get stuck by the jackknifed semi truck on the freeway, just that snow that's coming down from the sky is clearly not real, and it's like, oh, that's not great because the perspective doesn't really match. But maybe most people won't notice.
Doesn't matter. It didn't bother me nearly as much as the stunt guy, because we're so focused on the stunt guy. And at least with the snow stuff, we're watching Bill Murray's wonderful delivery of that line of how it's just a couple flakes. as he's chattering and trying not to fold over on himself and huddle up into a little ball for warmth. And he has this lovely line that he is the weather. So I quite like that. It's sort of a Judge Dreddish, I am the law. Although that movie came out after. One last thing I want to conclude on, because I think we've delved pretty deeply into the cycles, is how bad this movie poster is for this movie.
Yeah, it's not super great with him in the old fashioned alarm clock with the bells on top. Yeah,
that had nothing to do with
this. It's not in the movie. No, it's some very odd fonts. Andy McDowell is looking at the clock for some reason. It's bright and sunny outside in the background out this window. There's no snow to be seen either, which has nothing to do with anything. But yeah, we should have brought this up on Real Genius too, because there's a terrible poster for the U.S. version of Real Genius. But yeah, this is look at him. Bill Murray is stuck in the clock, and he's got his hands up like he's trying to push his way out of the glass.
I'm more than willing to bet that just from a couple visual cues, those are not his hands that he was holding up in this shot.
It's probably a headshot that was on that his agent sent them or something.
Yeah, like this is what I would call a Photoshop disaster. Although, you know, this is probably like...
Wait, Photoshop wasn't out in 93, was it? Or no, yeah, it probably was, wasn't
like,
it?
I think Photoshop 3. So you had alpha channels and everything. But the... and Andy McDowell, like, the photography for her, totally not the same. The light direction on everything is just all over the map. It's just like a bunch of random stuff. The text off to the side on the bottom so that they could squeeze her face into the side. Like, her eye is touching the edge of the poster. It's so... Mm-hmm. So bad. I just don't understand. And it's like forever this has been this movie classic gets heralded by this disaster of artwork to precede it. I think there are much better movie posters that could be made, and I would challenge our listeners to submit way better Groundhog Day movie posters.
I would also like to challenge our listeners to please, for the love of God, do not put our faces on this poster.
Oh, put Dan's face on Andy McDowell, please. Just Dan's face on everybody. Just
I think honestly I would fit better on Bill Murray because he has awful hair like I do.
I don't know. I don't think yours is as bad as Bill Murray. And you don't have that like sort of like a pockmarked silly putty thing going on.
He's got that weird scar like right between his eyes that I always see too. I wonder what happened.
Yeah, it's probably a story somewhere. He has a face with some character, and good for him. His life propels him forward into the future and in this timeline, having lots of action. So good job. And then.
But one other thing worth bringing up while we're wrapping this up here is, I guess I should look at this on IMDb too, but at least Wikipedia says the budget for this was $14.6 million. And that is pretty phenomenal, especially considering how well this movie turned out. I wish there were more $14 million movies that came out this good.
Yeah. One really strange thing is the color grading in this film. I just noticed this. I don't know if it's a transfer or what, but it is remarkably cool in tone. And this is all chemical process stuff back then. So I don't know if it was something they were intentionally going for, but like there's no vibrancy to anything. And it kind of sets the mood very effectively, I think. The night scenes all have like a really interesting rim light effect that they have to get like every little frizzy hair on Andy McDowell's head lit. it is really actually pretty interesting, especially when you consider like, you know, they can't just like slap on a power window and adjust something. Like, this is all just chemically graded film from regular film stock.
Maybe. Now, trying to put this in the 1993 context is always the way I try to look at it, especially since we've got Jurassic Park as a big milestone at that point. But the film grain in this one was pretty substantial, which is probably why I feel like this movie came out in the 80s, because it was very kind of grainy at times. But maybe, I mean, when they do Blu-rays, they do often go back and adjust color and tweak things that they couldn't do chemically processed back in 1983. But I thought the cinematography and the color looked it was good in terms of it worked for what it was doing. I'm not sure if I remember the overly cool stuff. It definitely probably was in a lot of the places where, especially when they're trying to make it look gray and depressing. But I thought there was a lot of really nice work in it in terms of cinematography and color. But I was watching the HD version, and I wonder if there was a retransfer done.
Yeah, no, I meant it in a complimentary way. I was just saying I couldn't remember from my memory of seeing it in a theater if it was that cool originally.
You can't remember color grading on a movie in 1983?
Yeah, I know. God, I'm the worst. But the other thing I was going to mention, a favorite credit of mine is Pembroke J. Herring, the editor, just because I like that name. Pembroke J. Herring. I want to name like a pug or a French bulldog or something Pembroke J. Herring. I think that is quite possibly one of the more amazing names that I've come across sitting through opening credits. So kudos to him.
Pembroke J. Pug would be a good one.
Yes, Pembroke J. Pug. But you know, it's really, I think, a very artful film when you consider the fact that it's a Bill Murray romantic comedy vehicle. So it really deserves, I think, tremendous amount of praise for how it's put together. And I don't feel like it gets slow or plodding or weird or anything. I think it still holds up today. Technologically, things like saying the word tape or the film cameras or the
Betacam tape.
Yeah, the Trinitron monitors, the, you know, all that stuff, like the long distance phone lines being down, like the problems that they have in the film with technology are kind of old fashioned and quaint in a way that allows for the convenient story to be told. But I don't think it detracts from it. I don't think it's beyond the realm of imagination to see how this whole thing pans out. So I still quite like it. I think it holds up very well for having been shot so many years ago.
Yeah, definitely agree. Mm-hmm. It's there's a reason this is on TV every year, because it's a good movie and it's fun to watch, and there's always some enjoyment to be had from watching this movie.
Yeah, I think it's mostly just because it's tied to a holiday that you can show annually.
This is not a holiday.
Groundhog Day is a holiday.
Nah, it's not a holiday.
It's on my Google calendar as a holiday. I don't get it off, but I don't work for a bank or anything.
Boy. Mm-hmm. They should run it in theaters every year then.
Oh, wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah, I wonder if they're gonna do that. Oh no, wait, we would have missed the 20-year anniversary.
Yes.
Maybe for the 25, it'll be back in theaters.
93.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Couple more years, I'm sure it'll be back in theaters. Yes. I can watch it.
A couple more years and it'll be 20 years again.
Right.
Wouldn't that be funny? Yes. Tomorrow you wake up in your bed and it's a couple years back and it's the 20th anniversary screening.
Oh god. Oh, I would have so much work to do.
You just have to drive to LA and you have to go try to see the 20th anniversary screening. Try
that's my time loop.
Yeah, try to get Bill Murray to absolve you of your sins of forgetting the day.
So I wake up February 12th, 2013.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that would be fine. I would still be on sabbatical from Intel. I would be getting paid to be on vacation.
Oh. Well, no, that can't do then. It needs to be something bad. Is there a terrible day that we can rehash for you? Just one.
This one's
though.
Stacking up. Okay.
You have to pick one.
Let me see. Let me tell you what my worst day of my life would be that we could relive.
Well, this is a reference to the fact that early on in the film, when he's talking about why did it have to be this
was great.
Day, and he's like talking about.
I was in the Virgin Island once. Mm-hmm. I met a girl. We ate lobster on the beach. That was a pretty good day. Why couldn't I have that one?
Yeah, so that's why I say it needs to be like a pretty not great day. But yeah, so it's a good plan, I think. We'll just
that was
a time loop.
Yeah, no, I'll pass on that one. It would be funny though if every year movie theaters announced it as the 20th anniversary of the film and re-released it every single year, just because that would be a funny joke. But. They probably wouldn't do that, but I do like that scene where he was hanging out talking to the locals, and when he's actually having he's doing the speech out loud about like there's no rules, what would you do, and like, they tell you to do this, they tell you to do that, they tell you not to drive on the railroad tracks, and I like how the one drunk guy's like, that's actually what I agree with, can we not drive on the railroad tracks playing chicken with a train?
Yeah, well, one of my favorite lines is when he's trying to describe his situation to them in the bar at the bowling alley. And he I can't remember the exact words, but he's saying that, you know, imagine being trapped in the same town and nothing that you do in your life matters. And the guy's like, yeah, you nailed it. that's their life.
I have similar feelings.
Mm-hmm. Particularly
because I wake up, I sit in front of this computer, I go to bed, and I do the same thing every day.
Yeah, well, the whole time I was watching it and listening to him like berate all of the people around him and call the townspeople hicks and everything, I was just like, oh, it's like Dan.
Except I am one of the townspeople.
Yes.
I don't live around hicks.
Oh no. Well, that was just the thing that he said in here.
Mm-hmm. I just want to put that on the record.
Yeah, yeah.
Arizona.
No, I understand. It's fine. We both know that you have maybe in the past said some words about the people who live around you that you don't, might not be considered flattering in a court of law.
Yeah, I have been flattering in a court of law.
I don't know. I was just making that up.
Can we make that the title?
Mm-hmm. flattering and affordable.
I have noticed, I'm beginning to notice that there are a few more interesting people around here than I thought. You know, there is a fancy company here that makes pens that has been on the Dragon Addict show.
Oh. Well,
I bought a pen from them recently.
I bought a pen case from them recently because I was going to give them money for the Atlanta flight thing. And I did. And I was like, well, a couple extra bucks and then I get a pen case. And I'm like, well, I don't know what I'm going to put in the pen case because I don't have any pens that I covet. I have pens. Like, I'm not bereft of pens.
you should cruise over to KarisCustoms.com and take a look at the handmade billet aluminum machined pens made in Mesa, Arizona here.
Oh. Or not.
They're nice.
Okay.
They're nice.
Okay. Yeah, that's nice. If you want to write things down on paper like an animal.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think that pretty much concludes our broadcast day. So
lucky for us, the blizzard is going to miss us and push east and connect with the moisture coming up from the south.
Mm-hmm. Well, not only that, but we are literally lucky because there was that actual blizzard that came through. And I'm in Florida, and you're in Arizona. Well, we're J-okay.
Yes, and it was poorly timed because you left your home of California, and you could have run into it, but no, you ended up going to Florida, so you're fine still.
Yeah, this whole travel experience is just magic. But, yeah. Anyway, blizzards. Dairy Queen.
I like my blizzards. I do the mud pie blizzard is pretty good. Mud pie. Yeah, the coffee one was pretty good. And I think they have an Oreo or a cookie dough one that I like as well. I haven't been to Dairy Queen in probably like 10 years.
Oh, I can't remember last time I was at one. Knowing the calorie count of those blended ice cream beverages.
Time out. You know the calorie count?
Well, not off the top of my head, but I mean, I know that I can look it up easily, and so that really defeats any enjoyment that I might have from it. Like the amount of calories that are, you know, Frosties and milkshakes and everything. It's just like, well, you know, it's a lot of ice cream and sugar and more sugar and then sugar on top of sugar. And then
I'm sure when you get back to the Beverly Hills there, you'll find somebody who makes a kale milkshake that is flavored to taste like an actual milkshake, but it's not a real one.
Oh my God, wouldn't that be amazing if it was just like kale and like spirulina and some maybe like one green apple for sweetness.
To be honest, if I was stuck in a Groundhog Day time loop, I would just eat. And that scene where he's stuffing all of the pastries in his mouth, that would be me like every day. Because who cares? Well, aren't you worried about cholesterol? And like, no.
Yeah, no, gross.
I would just do all of my, I would have the piano teacher meet me at Krispy Kreme and I would play my keyboard there and I just eat donuts all day long.
Yeah, but there's no burritos. There's no good Mexican food, no spicy food. It's Pennsylvania.
That would be, oh man, I could eat the spiciest food possible with no repercussions, indigestion or otherwise.
That's a good life goal, Dan.
Basically, my life goal is to have Pepto-Bismol with me at all times.
What if time travel is your Pepto-Bismol?